All right, let's set the stage.
It's 1136, and Geoffrey of Monmouth has just published The History of the Kings of Britain.
Within part of this narrative, a nun describes to the British King Vortigern a peculiar and impossible phenomena, the virginal conception of her son. In a speech to the king, she states,
"Upon your soul and mine, my lord king, I knew no man who begot this child of me. One thing, however, I do know, that when my companions and I were in our cells, someone resembling a handsome young man used to appear to me very often, holding me tight in his arms and kissing me. After remaining with me for a while, he would suddenly disappear from my sight. Often he would talk to me without appearing while I sat alone. He visited me in this way for a long time, and often made love to me in the form of a man, leaving me with a child in my womb. In your wisdom, you should know, my lord, that in no other way have I known a man who could have been this youth's father."
The nun describes what could be no other than an incubus, though the study of demonology and angelology would not begin to take form until approximately 1150, and its violent enforcement would not come about for millennia. Yet the creature's description mirrors demon attributes that would become commonplace centuries later in witchcraft treaties, such as the handsome in human disguise, approaching the nun during sleep, and the sudden disappearance after sex. Though, funnily enough, many of the illustrations and paintings that portray the conception of Merlin do not depict the incubus as either handsome or human. In a 15th century French painting of the scene, the nun in robes of brilliant cerulean blue sleeps in a bedroom furnished with burnt orange upholstery, completely unaware of the grotesque incubus spooning her. The beast looks malnourished, its joints knobby and its ribs sticking out. From its head rises two short horns and pointed long ears like that of a goat, while its feet resemble that of a bird. Its hand slides up her legs towards her hidden genitalia.
So, what became of that child?
Well, it was none other than Merlin the Wizard, perhaps one of the most ubiquitous wizard figures in Western culture.
Welcome to the Monstrous Desire Study podcast. I'm your host, Ella Gallego, the creator behind the Monstrous Desire Study. I talk about all things erotic monsters, from why people are attracted to them to tracing their existence historically across the globe. Today, we'll be discussing how the Church's crisis of belief plunged Europe into despair and hysteria, condemning the continent for decades, and how this crisis of belief was deeply intertwined with demon copulation and witchcraft theory. Content warning. This episode contains mentions and descriptions of sex, as well as assault and rape. Though stirrings of demonology and angelology would begin to emerge around 1150, both studies would still be in their infancy for approximately 100 years. Then, around 1250, religious theologians like Thomas Aquinas and Bonaventure produced comprehensive and thorough angelologies, thus opening the door to witchcraft and demonology theory. So the logic goes, where there are angels, there must be demons.
From there, things escalated quickly after 150 years of slow progress. By approximately the 1300s, witchcraft treaties and literature that described at length about demons and devils exploded, especially treaties pertaining to the physical interactions between witches and demons. Europe by then was fully in the clutches of witchcraft hysteria, and no one was safe from the frenzy. Men, women, and even children were accused of practicing or participating in witchcraft. These accusations were based on both a complicated and variable number of motivations, not all of which were spurred by what many believe to be driven wholly by misogyny. In her book, Enemies of God, author Christina Larner asserted that though witch hunting criminalized women as a group, quote, witchcraft was not sex specific, but it was sex related, end quote, due to the, quote, substantial proportion of male witches in most parts of Europe, which means that a witch was not defined exclusively in female terms, end quote. Despite the erroneous assertion of radical feminists like Andrea Dworkin, that approximated 9 million or more female victims died from witch hunting. A more realistic figure is that approximately 30 to 60,000 victims of both genders died within 300 years. This is not to undermine the role of violent misogyny in witch hunting. In the case of Scotland, who zealously took to witch hunting more so than neighboring countries like England, because Scotland appropriated the witch hunting patterns established on the continent, of an approximate total number of 3,837 accused, 84% were women, 15% were men, and 1% were unknown sex. Witchcraft theorist books like the infamous Malleus Maleficarum, written by Heinrich Kramer, outlined explicitly how women were naturally predisposed to evil and drew evilness to themselves through their insatiable lust. One such passage from the Malleus states,
"Women do all things because of carnal lust, which is insatiable in them. Wherefore, for the sake of fulfilling their lusts, they consort even with devils."
And that witches, quote,
"indulge in diabolical filthiness through carnal copulation with incubus and succubus demons, devoting themselves, body and soul, to devils."
The misogynistic ideology concerning the corrupting lust of women was not conceived during the Middle Ages, but rather can be traced back to Adam and Eve, in which Paul states that, quote, "the serpent seduced Eve by his craftiness," end quote. Eve's corruptible desires laid the groundwork for misogynistic ideology decades afterwards, especially by church clergy like the theologian and bishop of Milan, Ambrose, who concluded that, quote, "if Eve's door had been closed, Adam would not have been deceived, and she, under question, would not have responded to the serpent. Death entered through the window, i.e., through the door of Eve," end quote. Much like Heinrich Kramer, theologian and partial archbishop Isidore of Sevilla believed that the libidinous appetite of women was intrinsic to them, and that they were even named for it based on, quote, "the word femina, which derived from Greek to describe, quote, the force of fire because of her concupiscence, is very passionate. Women are simply more libidinous than men." So, if witchcraft accusations and hysteria were not sex-specific, but rather sex-related, then what gives? Well, for answers, we turn to Dr. Walter Stevens. In his book Demon Lovers, Witchcraft, Sex, and the Crisis of Belief, Dr. Stevens theorizes that misogyny was not the end goal of the church, but rather a catalyst for which the illiterate elite could exploit to, quote, "reinforce demonology and ultimately a theology." But why would the church want to reinforce demonology? It feels antithetical to Christianity. Just think of the myriad of horror movies that have come out about brave priests brandishing crosses and holy water like swords against possessed people spewing bright green vomit or terrifying demons. Yet, motives become more clear when we examine the text closely. According to Dr. Stevens, the church was motivated by a crisis of belief and could only prove the existence of corporeal beings through the physical interactions of witches and demons and devils. Through women's supposed libidinous appetite, the literate elite, specifically the church clergy, could possess not only a closer proximity to corporeal beings, but provide the proof that they were so desperate to reinforce across Europe. The church wielded misogyny so that they could exploit patriarchal oppression to, quote, "reinforce demonology and ultimately a theology," end quote, to resist skepticism that demons and other corporeal figures and spirituality at large were not real. Misogyny, especially the insatiable lust of witches, was ideologically useful, necessary even, in proving the physical existence of spiritual bodily contact through sensory data and bodily experience, as witches were the only ones who could identify demons and devils. Stevens contextualizes clergy and witch theorists as metaphysical voyeurs who necessitated the insatiable sexual desire of witches for legal proof of the existence of demons. Even Kramer admits that the function of the witch is to, quote, "make credible the notion that devils have regular bodily interactions with human beings," end quote. Per Stevens, quote, "without diabolophany or a shattering personal experience with a demon, The need for belief in demonic reality could never be satisfied, end quote. These religious anxieties were then violently forced upon the people of the Middle Ages, and a need for constant reaffirmation, extracted through torture and force as, quote, proof, and reinforced as, quote-unquote, truth, through witch theory treaties and literature. In fact, demonic copulation did not come about during witchcraft trials until the torture stage, many of which were scripted, to produce satisfactory answers for the interrogators that reaffirmed proof of corporeal relations. For the church, sex was a mode in which they would obtain not only irrefutable proof of demons, but knowledge of them as well. The more descriptive a witch's, quote, confession about the physical body of their demon lover or carnal knowledge, the more tangible proof clergy had at the indefinite existence of demons and corporeal beings. The crisis of belief in the reality of corporeal beings had metastasized within the church, escalating over a century until the obsession with obtaining physical proof of corporeal beings evolved into an outright fixation that manifested itself in violent witch trials that lasted hundreds of years, murdering thousands of innocent people. The late 13th century created a, quote, search for precision and certainty about a world that was invisible to humans, end quote, and, quote, generated significant perplexities and doubts, end quote. As such, the 1400s marked the beginning of the obsession for demonology and witchcraft theory, especially through demonolatry or sexual relations with demons. Early on, within the demonology craze of the 15th and 16th centuries, interactions between humans and demons was markedly different than what it would later develop into, specifically how women received pleasure during demon copulation. This was reflective within literature and treaties such as Gian Francisco Pico de la Mirandola's Strix, or also known as The Witch, and the full title of it being The Witch or On the Illusions of Demons. The book, originally published in Latin in 1523 and later translated into vernacular Italian in 1555, was a repertorial witchcraft treatise adapted into a dramatic reprisal dialogue between four characters, three male skeptical interrogators and one female witch, Strix. Strix, though technically fictional, was based on a witchcraft trial Gian Francisco had participated in and stood as a theatrical documentary investigation. The book evaluated at length the veracity of Strix, the witch, and her claims of demon copulation, specifically focusing on the witch's assertion that the sexual act was mind-blowingly pleasurable. One such interrogator from the book, Dicastus, puzzles through the idea that demonic copulation was intensely satisfying for Strix. From Dicastus,
witches claim they are so overcome by sexual pleasure that they swear there is no pleasure like it on earth. And I can think of several reasons why that would be true. First, because those rebellious spirits put on the most pleasing face. Next, because their viral members are uncommon size. With their faces they delight the eyes, and with their members they fill up the most secret parts of the witches. And beyond that, they pretend to be in love with them, which is perhaps the most welcome of their miserable miracles. And probably they can stimulate something very deep inside the witches, by means of which these women have greeted pleasure more than with men.
This intense pleasure was not relegated only to the female Strix either. Dicastus continued to describe how succubi produced a similar kind of otherworldly pleasure for men as well, which historically aligns with the large number of male witches who were accused of demonolatry within countries like Italy, such as the seven men out of the accused 10 witches that Gian Francisco not only played a hand in their torture and subsequent murders, but based his book upon. In 1470, for example, Dominican Giordano da Bergamol wrote his own treatise in which he describes the biographical, or as much as it perhaps ever could be, story of a hermit who lived in northern Italy. So the story goes, the devil had taken the appearance of a beautiful woman and seduced a hermit until both had passionately embraced. After the deed had been done, the devil cast aside his disguise and gleefully taunted, Look at what you've done. I'm not a girl or a woman, in fact, but the devil. Having obtained what he needed, aka the semen, for further production of demons and devils, the devil disappeared immediately, proving that his words were true and that he was, in fact, the devil. However, the hermit had been so drained of his semen that he shriveled up and died a month later. Though diabolophony through sexual encounters was a commonplace occurrence and accusation between the 1400s through the 1700s, a lapse in witchcraft theology and trials occurred approximately in the 1520s. A 40-year lull drastically slowed the production and publication of both new and old witchcraft treaties and literature. However, this lull was not long-lived, and by the 1570s, would recommence once again, this time more fervently and violently, escalating in yet another publication proliferation of witchcraft treaties and literature, both old and new. After 1570, the accused during confessions no longer spoke about the intense pleasure they received during demonic copulation, but rather attested to how painful, unwanted, and unpleasant it was. Confessions were, quote, far more violent and lurid than those typically of the period ending in the 1520s, end quote, casting aside descriptors of intense pleasure or physical exhaustion for more sensationalist descriptions. Pleasure and exhaustion were no longer adequate signs of demonic copulation, and as such, the devil had to, quote, demonstrate his virility by going beyond the bounds of virilimicitude. This meant that demons and devils' penises grew to exaggerated and over-the-top lengths. Quote, their ejaculate was incredibly copious, both penis and semen had to be so cold as to cause intense pain, end quote, and the number of members doubled, sometimes tripled, for simultaneous penetration. This frantic reestablishment of resistance to skepticism would last until the late 1700s, until which time witchcraft theory would begin to fall out of favor amongst, quote, learned men, and become nothing more than mere old wives' fables. After the break, we'll come back to discuss the specificities of the accused confessions, look at how the physical bodies of demons and devils were described, including their genitalia, as well as how sex was described. Welcome back to the Monstrous Desire Study podcast. Within the first half of the episode, I briefly discussed the context in which demon copulation occurred, as well as traced the approximate timeline alongside the fervency of witchcraft theory in Europe during the Middle Ages. Now, however, I'm going to focus on the specificities of the accused confessions, looking at how the physical bodies of demons and devils were described, including their genitalia, as well as how sex was described. There was a shift in cultural perception of demon copulation before and after 1570. Prior to 1570, accused witches routinely described sex as not only intensely pleasurable, but that their lovers immensely beautiful as well. Yet after the revamping of witchcraft theory in 1570, gone were the days of accusations of sexual pleasure. Let's first stick to the descriptions prior to 1570. There's a consistency to demons and devils' physical descriptions by the accused that can be broken down into four categories: anthropomorphic, impossibly beautiful human, human with inhuman feet, and monstrous. The descriptor consistency can probably be attributed to the fact that interrogators relied upon scripted questions to bully or torture victims into confessing whatever aligned with and bolstered their vision for corporeal interactions. Prior to 1520, and as early as the 1100s, demons were described as handsome and overtly beautiful. Merlin's mother testifies to this in Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain, remember that from the beginning, in which she describes the mysterious incubus who visited her routinely in her chamber at night as, quote, someone resembling a handsome young man, end quote, who, quote, often made love to her in the form of a man, end quote. It's crucial to note here that Merlin's mother does not state that she was visited by a man, but rather something that resembled a man, indicating that she knew it was not human, despite its beautiful disguise. In the 1523 book Strix, the accused witch, which is being questioned and interrogated about her sexual encounter with a demon by three men. She tells the men that her demon lover, Ludovictus, has appeared in every sense as a normal man, except for one small detail, his feet. They were those of a goose in reverse, so they pointed backwards. One such interrogator, Dacastus, explains the reason for this is because while the devil can nearly create a, quote, perfect facsimile of the human body, end quote, he can never truly get the feet right, as God purposefully makes them come out inversos et pre posteros, so that people are not fooled in the presence of demons and devils. When asked if Ludovictus had shown Strix any other kind of feet besides goose-like, Strix replied, never any other, and that he, quote, never appeared in any form but human if he intended to copulate with me, end quote. The reality of this framing positions the accused as automatically guilty of sinning, as they have no excuse for knowing they had sex with unholy corporeal beings with such a dead giveaway. We see these strange bird-like feet in many paintings and prints, such as the German print Devil Seducing Witch. Approximately printed in the late 1400s, the print depicts a witch and a devil clutching each other tightly in the rolling hills of the country. The witch holds her hands to the devil's forearms, looking upon his face. The devil has tusks and a tufted tail, and there, right at the bottom of his long legs, are the clawed feet of a bird. A similar confession to that of Strix's took place in Germany in 1587, in which a licensed midwife named Walpurga Hausmannen confessed to not only malficia, aka harmful magic, but demonolatry, or sexual relations with demons. 31 years before her trial in 1556, Walpurga engaged in a one-night stand romp with a fellow worker. However, after having sex, Walpurga began to notice terrifying peculiarities about her lover that pointed to him not being human at all, but the devil. His feet were cloven hooves, and one of his hands appeared, quote, as if made of wood. Walpurga realized with horror what she had done. However, this did not prevent her later the next night from having sex with the devil yet again when he returned in the same form, and then later yet embarking on, quote, a continuous orgy of sexual excess with the devil. Demons, devils, and the capital D devil's physical form, however, are often described in a manner that implied fluidity and genderlessness. According to the theologian Thomas Aquinas, demons had no sex so that they could appear to their victims as either men or women. In Dominican Charles René Buard's Angelology Treaty, Tractatus de Angelis, the Dominican wrote that, quote, the same evil spirit may serve as a succubus to a man, and as an incubus serve a woman, end quote. This fluidity was thought to be motivated not by a desire for self-pleasure or joy, as, according to the French judge Delancre, demons were incapable of feeling joy or pleasure, but a desire to degrade and humiliate man, as well as a sole purpose of lasciviousness. This was due to the theory that demons and devils were unable to produce their own semen, and so were forced to steal the fluid from men as succubus and later reuse the emission to inject within women as incubus. The genderlessness of demons was mentioned often by clergy and theologians, such as Francisco Maria Guasso, who in 1608 wrote the Compendium Maleficium and stated that,
for devils can assume the bodies of dead men or recreate for themselves out of air and other elements, a palpable body like that of flesh, and to these they can impart motion and heat at their will. They can therefore create the appearance of sex, which they do not naturally have, and abuse men in a feminine form, and women in a masculine form, and lie on top of women, or lie under men. And they can also produce semen, which they have brought from elsewhere, and imitate the natural ejaculation of it.
Wind servicing women, devils, and demons initially were described as well endowed, though not all. Henry Bouguet, a well-known jurist and judge in the county of Burgundy, as well as a famous demonologist who wrote a demonology book that was reprinted 12 times in 20 years, joked that none of the witches in Franche-Comté had, quote, seen a demon's flesh devil's penis longer than a finger and correspondingly thin, end quote, and that Satan served other countries better than he did in the Franche-Comté. A 17-year-old witness examined by de Lancre testified that the devil always had a member, quote, like a mule's, having chosen to imitate that animal as best endowed by nature, that it was as long and as thick as an arm, and that he always exposed his instrument of such beautiful shape and measurements, end quote. The girl had confessed further that not only did the devil have a member like the mule's, but that he had, quote, appeared as both man or goat. This anthropomorphic form was yet another common description of demons and devils. However, it especially became more frequent in 1570, when witch theory and witch trials not only recommenced, but did so when demon relation confessions began to become more violent and sensationalist, removing itself from the idea that the act was pleasurable for the accused. In the case of the character Strix, from Pico Strix, when the interrogators questioned how a demon could even copulate if they have, quote, neither bones or flesh, Strix supplied that the parts put on by them are similar to flesh and bone, but bigger than those of any mortal, end quote, and that their parts were, quote, softer and very similar to flax or cotton wool that has been bundled and densely packed, end quote. This did not interfere with Strix's pleasure while having sex with a demon, a pleasure like no other on Earth, and one of the interrogators surmised that this was due to the demons presenting themselves as beautiful, well-endowed good lovers, and that they were pretending to be in love with the witches. Early accounts, especially those prior to 1520, described the intense pleasure of diabolic intercourse as an act that left people physically exhausted for days. In 1485, for example, Inquisitor Nicholas Jacquier explained that demonic copulation was inordinately carnal, and that many witches, quote, for several days afterwards remained work out, aka exhausted. Other accounts in Italy further confirmed this, such as Griandus, the famous papal lawyer, who reported that women confessed they enjoyed sexual relations with the devil with great pleasure, or, quote, maxima cum voluptit. In fact, exhaustion, accused to have been brought about from sexual activities with demons and devils, in early witchcraft theory treatise was a preliminary sign of demonolatry by many theorists, including Jacquier. According to Stevens, Jacquier claimed to have interviewed the servants of those who fornicated with demons, who testified that they often found their masters and mistresses bedridden and exhausted on Friday. Some even stayed abed several days thereafter. It became clear that the cause was sexual overindulgence at the Sabbath, which is always held on Thursday night. Sexual satisfaction and pleasure was such a key point when describing demon copulation that theorists like Girolamo Visconti, a Milanese Dominican who wrote two witchcraft theory treatises in 1460, described how witches enticed newcomers into their sect by describing the sexual pleasures that awaited them at the Sabbath. According to Visconti, female witches lured women to the witches' game with the promise of handsome young men, and male witches with the promise of beautiful women. Both men and women would find, quote, every kind of pleasure and sensuality that one can enjoy while at the Sabbath, especially because every person was assigned their own personal sex demon, quote, with whom they have sexual intercourse, and who appears to them often, both in the home and outside it, when they are wide awake, as they themselves affirm. The physical form of demons and devils and the manner in which sex with demons and devils was portrayed took a turn after 1520, especially during the vehement resistance to skepticism rehabilitation after 1570. The devil's member was mentioned as being bifurcated, or cum membro bifurcato, as early as 1520, as well as trifurcated. In this form, demons and devils could, according to witnesses, perform, quote, both coitus and pederasty at once, while sometimes a third prong reached into his lover's mouth, end quote. Whether or not you find double or triple penetration with demons as titillating, it was not sexual tantalization that drove the church to portray demonic copulation thusly. Rather, intense pleasure and or physical exhaustion were inadequate, quote, signs that demon copulation was real, end quote, and that all descriptions concerning demonolatry had to be exaggerated to great lengths to push the envelope of believability. Demons and devils' penises became overtly large to the point of pain, their ejaculation copious and painfully freezing. Semen, when ejaculated into witches, brought them, quote, no pleasure, but rather horror, end quote, which, in some sense, comforted witchcraft theorists and theologians because they felt that such negative experiences wouldn't allow for any, quote, issues to come of such a union, end quote. However, the ice-cold semen was only experienced by, quote, witches who were fully aware that he is a devil. Mark of Ephesus noted that witches' confessions remarked that sex was entirely devoid of pleasure and caused them now acute pain. No longer were demons and devils' members described as being of such, quote, beautiful shape and measurements, end quote, but rather something to be perceived with horror, such as one of Delancre's witnesses who described the devil's penis as, quote,
generally sinuous, pointed and snake-like, made sometimes of half iron and half flesh, at other times wholly of horn, and commonly forked like a serpent's tongue.
A similar testament was given by a 15-year-old girl, Marie, who lived in Biarritz, France. Marie affirmed that the devil's member was indeed two parts, constructed in part as half iron and half flesh, his testicles no different. Her participation in the Sabbat allowed her to see the devil in his form many times, including the manner in which women who slept with the devil cried out, quote,
like woman in travail with child, and that he always held his toe exposed.
If it wasn't the copious and freezing semen or the gargantuan multiple penises that were causing women painful sex, other theorists believed that painful sex was caused because the devil's penis was actually made out of horn, or at least appeared as such. Descriptions of bestial demon copulation increasingly became more commonplace. Authorities like Karpsov in 1635 and Pott in 1689 remarked that the devil's form appeared as animal or bird, specifically serpents, goats, or ravens, though their animal forms did not inhibit demons and devils from copulation. Quote, before they were burned, the Scottish witches at Borrowstones in 1679 testified to the commissioners how the devil would have carnal dealing with them in the shape of a deer or in any other shape, now and then. Sometimes he would be like a stork, a bull, a deer, a roe, or a dog, and have dealings with them. In Bouguer's widely popular demon theory book, Bouguer believed that the devil frequently assumed the shape of a dog to abuse women, while in Delancre's tableau of 1612, witness Johannes swore,
the devil in the form of a goat, having his member in the rear, had intercourse with women by juggling and shoving that thing against their belly.
Marie, aged 15, a resident of Biarritz, affirmed that she had often seen the devil couple with a multitude of women whom she knew by name and surname, and that it was the devil's custom to have intercourse with the beautiful women from the front and the ugly from the rear. Painful demon copulation testimonies, as well as witchcraft theory, would persist into the end of the 17th century, in which case much of Europe, quote, had lost their certainty about the prevalence, if not the potency, of Maleficium, the danger, if not the existence, of diabolical conspiracy, and the practicality, if not the possibility, of identifying and punishing those involved in either pursuit. By the 1700s, witchcraft theory was largely dismissed, and the devil transformed into a being of, quote, at most a moral influence and possibly a complete fiction, end quote. And those who clung to the idea that demons or devils were physically real were thought to be fools or mentally unwell. This did not mean that testimonies of Maleficium or demonolatry disappeared outright. Vigilante actions against accused witches took place in the 19th and 20th centuries. However, the, quote, virtual cessation of legal actions against witches by the end of the 18th century confirmed the profound change that Europe had begun to undergo in the previous century, end quote. In the case of Henri Fuseli, the Anglo-Swiss painter behind The Nightmare in 1781, though witchcraft theory was not explicitly present in the suggestive oil painting, the grotesque demon perched upon the chest of the sleeping voluptuous woman echoes remnants of a not-so-far-gone era of demonolatry. In the painting, a woman in a nightgown lies prone on her bed while a goblin-like incubus sits on her chest. In the background, a mare peeks her head through the curtains to gaze upon the nightmare scene. Though Fuseli never remarked on the symbolism of the piece, the painting is rich with erotic iconography, from the woman swooning full form to the imp or incubus sat on a chest. In fact, many art historians interpreted the painting to be representative of sublimated sexual instincts, with the incubus standing to represent the male libido and the intrusive horse head peeking through the curtain representing sex itself. Marcia Allentuck in Woman as Sex Object even argues that the painting's intent was to portray the female orgasm. Fuseli would not only create multiple versions of this painting, but produce yet another painting concerning the subject of incubus and women in 1794, titled The Incubus Leaving Two Sleeping Women. Striking artistic similarities would find themselves duplicated in other artists' work, indicating the influence not only of demonolatry, but of Fuseli as well. Sexuality, eroticism, and horror would not relegate itself to the Middle Ages. Rather, its influences would not only reach artists like Fuseli and shape their work, but stretch beyond the era and extend into the Gothic period, impacting horror writers like poet Erasmus Darwin, Mary Shelley, and Edgar Allan Poe, all of whom were inspired by Fuseli's titillating and shocking work. If you are curious about the paintings and artwork discussed in this episode, or would like to look up my citations, you can see all such things on my website, The Monstrous Desire Study, specifically on the blog page Carnal Desires and the Crisis of Belief, Demon Copulation in Europe and Witchcraft Accusations, Part 1 and 2. Special thanks for the production of this episode goes to the voice actors who helped me bring this episode to life. Credited in order of their appearance is Casper Chatelier as Merlin's mother, Henning Bedreau as Heinrich Kramer, Federico Foglia as Dicastus and Francisco Maria Guazzo, Eloise Kimberly as young Frenchwoman witness and Marie, and lastly, Alexander as Johannes. Until next time.